Quel est le point de métal?
Wrestling fans, and welcome to Shut Up and Wrestle, a wrestling history podcast about good conversations and great stories. I am your host, Brian R. Solomon, and welcome to episode 114. It is WrestleMania week, and in some ways, this is a WrestleMania edition of Shut Up and Wrestle, not necessarily because we'll be talking about WrestleMania, but because on this week's edition, I'm doing my first ever WWE employee roundtable discussion. This was a concept that was first suggested to me some weeks ago by Brian Last. The reason being the recent allegations against Vince McMahon and a lot of the other kind of dirty laundry that's been coming out regarding WWE in recent months, and we thought it might be a good idea to bring a few of my fellow compatriots from the world of WWE, former employees, former denizens of Titan Tower and of the road, and to share some of our thoughts and our memories in a nuanced way of our experiences working at WWE. So I've got this roundtable episode this week featuring Head of Security Jimmy Noonan, Creative Services Director Deb Jasway, who's been on the show before, and WWE.com web editor Lou DiPietro. That is still to come. A couple things I want to get to. First, the June issue of Pro Wrestling Illustrated is now on sale in digital form at PWI-online.com. You can get it there. The print edition will be available in a couple of weeks, but you can get the digital version on their website. Inside that issue, the June issue, it has my column, The Way It Was, which this month focuses on the mega powers in light of the kind of year-spanning bloodline saga of WWE. I wrote a retrospective of the WWF's old-school year-spanning epic storyline, the Mega Powers. So that's in the new issue, June issue, on sale digitally at PWI-online.com. Also want to keep you up to date on the progress of Irresistible Force, the life and times of Gorilla Monsoon. I am now deep into chapter 7 of the book, which takes a look at Gorilla's mid-1960s sojourn to the West Coast, his wrestling exploits in California, 1965, 66, and also looks at his triumphant return in the late 60s to the Worldwide Wrestling Federation for one last hurrah with Bruno Sammartino. So in light of that, I also want to say that this book's going to have a lot of detail in it. These matches, I think a lot of people are going to be very pleasantly surprised at the level of detail that I'm able to include when talking about some of the matches that Gino had in the 1960s, thanks to the extensive coverage that they received in newspapers at the time. So that's something to look forward to. I will continue to keep you abreast of the progress of Irresistible Force. But now, without further ado, I'd like to take you to the main course here this week. I think you are really going to like this. This turned into something bigger than I imagined that it would be. And I want to say, too, this is only going to be the first of these roundtables because I've got a lot of other interests from other people. It's a little bit longer than usual. I decided not to break it up into multiple episodes because it is a roundtable. It is four people talking. So I felt it needed a little bit more time than I usually give in order for all of it to breathe, in order for everyone to get their ideas in. And I think this is really something special that we created. I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to take you to it right now. Okay, so it's my pleasure this week on Shut Up and Wrestle to do something that I have never done before on this show, which is a round table. We have a panel of guests this week, and it's for an important reason. As we've been talking about on the show, with things going on lately in the news and stories of Vince McMahon and others, and a lot of discussion about the culture at WWE, the corporate culture, the road culture, I thought, and Brian Last also thought, it would be a great idea to do this kind of roundtable discussion with a group of different employees of WWE from different parts of the company. And I may do more than one of these, but this is the very first one. So I'd like to welcome my three guests this week. One of them, listeners of the show already know because she's one of the most popular guests that I have ever had on the show. Debbie, the response to your episode was amazing. She was from 1990 to 2005. She worked in the creative services department. She was senior creative director, Deb Jazway. Deb, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me back. And it's so nice to hear that it was so positively received the first time around. So this is a wonderful forum and you are very good at what you do. So thank you. And I'm really excited to be here. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah, that was actually the first episode I had with a former Titan Tower employee. So we set the standard. I also have with me a longtime friend, a fellow writer, a fellow content editor. He worked for WWE.com as a content editor from 2004 to 2008. Also, because he's a glutton for punishment, he came back in 2018 and spent 2 years as a digital content editor for the brand new at the time WWE Network. And his name is Lou DiPietro, a.k.a. Louie D. Louie, thanks for coming on the show.
Peace, all. Good to be reunited with you, sir. Cafeteria tater tots for everyone.
Oh, man. You just unlocked a memory. That's great. Thank you. And last but most certainly not least, I have somebody here who, let me just put it this way. If you watched WWE programming in the, let's say from 1999 to 2007, and you watched closely, you know this person, you know what he looks like. He was the director of security during those years, Mr. Jimmy Noonan. Noonan, Jimmy, thank you so much for coming on the show.
What's up, kids? Good to be here.
This is great. So I have a nice wide range of people, which is exactly what I wanted to have to do this the first time. So, you know, like I said, when I started or when I was introducing everybody, we've been hearing, like with everybody else, we've been hearing all these things lately in the news and stuff coming out little by little. Everybody all of a sudden feels, you know, like they want to tell their story, even things that happened a long, long time ago. And I've been in touch with other people that used to work there that have crazy, insane things that they probably will never even talk about, but they've just been, everybody I know that worked there has been buzzing over these things. So I'm just curious, you know, what some of your reactions have been lately to a lot of these things. Maybe Deb, maybe we could start with you.
Well, I don't know if you can tell from my expression, but I'm absolutely not surprised. And I think, you know, especially just knowing the nature of the beast that it was, you know, always and, you know, continues to be, that of course there's going to be, you know, inappropriateness, let's put it that way. And if it goes all the way down from, you know, from up top all the way down through corporate, it didn't come as a shock. Anything I've heard didn't come as a shock at all. So not even knowing what people's stories are, I'm sure they are aplenty. But again, you know, my take on it, and I won't say too much too soon, but I'm from the 90s, and things were very, very different in the 90s. So if you're hearing stories about things that were crazy, well, it was the 90s, and that was before Me Too, and that was before we had sexual harassment training. I mean, that started early 90s, but other than that, it was a free-for-all. I mean, it was the WWF under a roof, you know, acting like grown-ups and doing the corporate thing, but at the end of the day, it was still this crazy circus, and I'm sure, you know, Jimmy can speak to that, you know, as well. It's like, it's a beast.
And Jimmy,
great stories, crazy stories.
So Jimmy, I'll turn to you on that because I have some thoughts on that. I want to hear what you have to say, because obviously, more than any of us here, you were the guy on the road out there week after week, You know, in if corporate and the tower was nuts, it was nothing compared to the road. I mean,
well, I like the almost the play on words from Deb, the nature of the beast. You know, what does that mean? Well, we know what it means, and then you know, they could take a whole nother meaning there. Listen, you know, to stay surprised, no, nobody's surprised. You know, you can't be surprised. Big guys, alpha males, you know, testosterone, anabolic steroids, you know, divas and tough enough girls, and then the, you know, the women and the Stacey Keeblers and the Tori Wilsons and the oh my God. And then the women coming down from corporate, then the women coming down on the weekends to do TV. And all of a sudden, I don't know, WWE must've been all of a sudden just hiring hot women. It was ridiculous. And the other thing is, I don't know if I can't remember where I heard this. I don't know if it was Vince in an interview or secondhand information driving in the car with Benoit and Eddie and Angle or with Dave Bautista, but or watching Vince say it one night. But Vince was straight up, you know, I'm the craziest sex. You think you know crazy sexual stuff? I'm the craziest sexual beast out there. Like, Vince would be straight up that he's Vince. He is who he is. And, you know, I mean, you can't, nobody can be surprised. And my guess is, you know, that this is, I mean, what are we, 3, 4, 5 months into these stories? I don't know. I guess it started with the Rita Chatterworth or something like that. Maybe
yeah,
six,
Rita,
8 months
Rita Chatterton,
ago.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
What do we think? I mean, we have to think it's only going to get worse. I don't wish badly on the guy, but it's only going to get worse. I'm a little sad that Johnny's dragged into this. Not Johnny's dragged into this because we don't know Johnny's culpability. I happen to be very fond. And by the way, I'm a Vince guy. I was very fond of Vince. I tell everybody for years, I saw the world on Vince McMahon's dime, and I saw it in first class. You're never going to hear a bad word about Vince about me. But Johnny and I were closer, and Johnny was very good to me. So that kind of bothers me that he's somehow implicated and he's involved in this thing. It kind of makes me sad, but more people are going to drop.
Oh, no question about it. And there was with Johnny, there was that kind of, I'm sure you guys saw, there was that interesting response that he had through his lawyers, where he's claiming, I mean, whether true or not, to have been really manipulated into the whole thing as well. I mean, that could be by Vince. That could
and
be
would,
just.
And would that surprise anybody, Brian?
No, it would not. And I know, like, everybody's knee-jerk reaction is like, oh, please give me a break. You're a grown man and all that stuff. But like, you know, you wouldn't say that about Janelle Grant. I mean, she's a grown woman, too, but she got pulled into it and manipulated and sucked yeah. into these things. And so I think there's probably a kernel of truth to that. Lou, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'd like to pull you in. What have you thought about the things that have been coming out?
Well, you know, they say in life, Brian, that the best wrestling characters are just you turned up to 11. So the man who was the genetic jackhammer with huge grapefruits in the Attitude Era being this, you know, can you be surprised? No. You know, to the point you and Noonan just made, you know, Vince was Vince, right? Vince was the larger than life character, the billionaire owner, the guy. So, you know, if John Laurinaitis's defense is Vince made me do it, there's probably other people whose defenses that will be, you know, brought into this that Vince made me do it. And any of us on the inside at any point should not be surprised if that's actually true. You know, it's, you know, you and I, Brian, we worked for a different McMahon for a long time, you know, and we
that
know,
would be Shane, right? Yes, of
right.
course.
You know, Shane was always more Linda and Stephanie was always more Vince in terms of personality, even though they all shared their McManus. So we saw a little bit of that side. I mean, you know that absolute power corrupts absolutely, right? So when Vince tells you to jump, you say how high, because there was 100 million people that wanted your job, whether it was mine, Deb's, yours, Noonan's, especially correct, the guys on the road. You know, I remember Brian when he tore both of his quads after the Rumble in 05, running into the guy in the elevator, going to the gym at 9 o'clock at night, doing something because it was Mania season. He was still an intimidating figure to me, and I was 25 and 300 pounds and in much better shape than I am now with this double chin. And I was still kind of like, damn. So imagine what that's like when that's your boss and he's, you know, kind of gently suggesting you do things.
There was definitely a presence, certainly. I mean, that was the thing about WWE, and people always, and it's not the case anymore. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out, but people would always talk about that back in the day as being one of the strong suits of the company, and why the company would do so much better than, let's say, a WCW or whatever, because they had unquestionably a person at the top who was the last word on everything, and everybody knew it. The buck stopped there. I mean, we used to joke in publications, for people who remember back in the day, you know, Michael Eisner, when he was the head of Disney, I think now it's Bob Iger is the guy's name. Could you imagine the head of Disney, the absolute tip-top guy, sitting down and having to approve goofy t-shirt designs, right? That's not going to happen, right? In WWE, it did, because that control was everything right at the top. Deb, did you have a lot of dealings directly with Vince or with the other McMahons? Because I know your department, you had Debbie Bonanzio, so you were maybe a little more shielded than some.
After I was a creative director on all promotion and marketing, it was weekly Vince meetings where he approved what the artwork was for that particular upcoming pay-per-view. He would go around the table. He would review t-shirt designs. He would review pay-per-view posters. His word was final. He always had great creative input. I'll give him that. But yeah, when you talk about control, Vince's hand was in everything. And he was, as Lou said, a larger than life, powerful, very powerful man. And he had immense, immense respect. Someone described his personality as paralyzing. And that I've never forgot that. And to ride in an elevator with him or any of the McMahons or any of the talent for that matter, you felt so small. So there is that amount of power and control. So when you say that, you know, John would have done whatever Vince asked him, maybe that's also part of Vince's, I don't want to get into too much of what, you know, my opinion is. It is part of having control over someone. So when you say, how high should I jump? And someone serves somebody up to you, you're like, okay, you know, I'm part of this game. So again, I think I shouldn't talk too much on Vince's issue, but knowing his personality from a corporate level, the power and the control was unchecked since we started, you know, at the tower and probably before that. So it's just, look where it's got us. Look where it's gone.
And I think with me, I had a few over the years. I would have dealings with Vince because, like Lou said, we worked for Shane. So that kind of brought us into the orbit, maybe sometimes more than we would have liked. Because like what they used to say is the best way to keep your job there safely is to not have to work directly for the McMahons, because it's like getting too close to the sun. You know what I mean? It's like I'd rather be on Earth than on Mercury. You know what I mean? So like, that's what it felt like being in publications. We had a little safety, a little bit, but we had Shane. And so through Shane, we had access to Vince. And my experience, and Jimmy, like I said, you've been probably around him more than any of us here, I'm assuming. My experience was sometimes it would depend on the day. It would depend, like, you never knew. It was like almost like what side of the bed did he get up in the morning? Because with everything we know now aside, and I just want to say, at the time that I worked there, I had no idea about stuff like this. I mean, you know, you'd always hear some things, but there was no inkling to me of things like this. But I had experiences where I got along great with him. I felt like we were really connecting and bonding over certain similar shared topics or whatever. And then there would be times where it would almost be like the person you saw the character on television, except maybe with the volume slightly, slightly down. And so you never really knew what you were going to get. I don't know, Jimmy, if you had a similar experience.
I had a very weird relationship with Vince in the sense that I saw him. I was the first person he saw every Sunday, if it was pay-per-view, Monday and Tuesday. Okay, I was the first person he saw when he got to the arena. I would always, you know, have security. I'd get there around 10:30. Talent would start showing up around 1, and Vince would get there somewhere between me and then, you know, probably closer to 11, 11:30, 12. And I'm talking about Vince and Steph and probably Paul, or Paul would already be on the road, depends. And then all the writers, Kasama and, you know, all the writers. And so I knew where Vince was sitting always. Vince always sat in the same seat, and I'd go and I'd open the door and he'd get out. And then I would be the last person to see Vince that night, you know, before he went back to the hotel, because I walked him to his car. And there were months when Vince and I didn't say a word to each other. And then it got so stupid, like it was just so ludicrous that, you know, like there was no hello, goodbye, you know, that I would start messing with him, you know, like I'd open the door and I'd speak into my watch. I'd go, "The eagle has landed, the eagle has landed." And he'd look at me, go, you know, like just to get his attention. Like, do right. You even know my name, dude? You know what I mean? And then we got closer, you know, and then we got closer, and then, it, you know, and then there would be days still we wouldn't talk for weeks and weeks. And then he'd, you know, get out of the car and he'd say, you know, "How you doing, buddy?" And I'd copy his voice. I'd go, "Good, how you doing, buddy?" And he'd just look at me like, I just, you know, what was he going to fire me? I think he was kind of amused with me after a while. Stephanie, you didn't mess, you know, you didn't do that right. with. Stephanie wasn't a ha-ha. Unless Stephanie was initiating the ha-ha. The other thing is, I want to say real fast, is you guys said, Lou brought up the fact that you two worked for Shane. Yeah. And I kind of dug Shane's, the whole thing about Shane and why Shane was gone after, what, 2003, 2002, whatever it was.
It was 2010. Yeah, yeah, 2010, actually, yeah.
Well, no, he was, well, then there was well, a would, long time.
Right.
Yeah,
no, he started going
to
China.
He disappeared for long right. times, because I think I remember that he was working on the Chinese TV deal, or he was trying to get to, you true. Know, something like that. But anyway, but his thing was, he didn't want to, he knew what was going on, and he didn't, you know, what came out in the last few months, he knew, he had an idea what was going on, and he didn't want to be a part of it, or he didn't want to be like his dad, or he didn't want to be, you know, guilty by suspicion. I kind of dug that, and that totally, for me, that landed. That totally made sense to me.
Yeah, it did for me too. And about the China thing, just a couple of things. It's funny because I was, you know, in the office with him when he wasn't full time on the road anymore by about the end of 2001. He kind of transitioned to running our departments and things and being more in the office than on the road. So I'd be around him most days of the week. Some weeks he wouldn't even go to TV at all. And there was a time there for by the mid 2000s where, yeah, he would all of a sudden disappear and he'd be in China for stretches of time. And we started almost having a running gag. Like, we were thinking, what the heck is he doing in China? Like, is he running some type of drug cartel, or like what is happening over there? Is he, I mean, now it's not even funny, but we were like going, is he in a sex trafficking ring in China? What's happening? But what we didn't know is what was happening was he was setting up this deal that would enable him to get the hell out of the company, because even though it didn't work out, the video streaming deal, he was working out this deal to bring, for people that don't know, to bring movies, streaming American movies to China, which they didn't really have at the time, like a video on demand thing. And once he got all the pieces in place, he left in 2010. Now, I just want to say something quick about Shane, and then I want to ask you, Lou, because That, like Jimmy, like what you said, it completely jived with me and with the Shane that I knew when I was reading that about, you know, some of the stories about, well, maybe that Shane knew this and he didn't want to be a part of this. It makes perfect sense to me, unfortunately, that, you know, with the whole kind of macho thing and the father-son thing, that of all the McMahons around Vince, that Shane would have been the one who was most aware of what was going on and most exposed to it. Because obviously, Vince is not going to talk to Linda about this, obviously. He's not going to bring Stephanie into it, obviously. God help us, I hope not. The person most likely for him to be like, hey, pal, would be his son, Shane. So when I, you know, the pieces started clicking in my head, like, oh my God, what a horrible position that must have been like to be in. But I want to talk to you, Lou, because like I said, we both worked directly for him. And I think we got him at different stages. Like, you were working for him a little bit earlier than I was. Well, I don't want to say that. I want to say he was more involved in the web first, and then he became more involved in the magazines. And I think it really was taking a toll on him the more time went by. I think Web Shane was a more happy-go-lucky, fun Shane than Magazine Shane was. I don't know what your take was on that.
Yeah, it's possible. And then there was that period of time where we merged, and I think you were technically my boss for a little while.
Don't remind me.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, you know, you talk about happy-go-lucky Web Shane. I can tell you a story. I remember sitting in the video PA cubicle over there, right across from Shane's office, you know, and cutting up videos for what was then WWE Jukebox. Amazing to see what that's morphed into now with the network, right? This used to, let's buy a match online for 99 cents and watch.
Oh God, I remember that. Yeah. Oh my God. Yeah.
And you just, I felt this presence behind me, and I had my headphones on because I'm cutting up stuff, and I hear grunt, and I turn around, and there's Shane just like marking out for an Undertaker match. Like, okay, well, all right. So he's still a fan. He, you know, like whatever. And then, you know, like you said, as time went on, he got more and more stuff thrown on his plate. And, you know, I can still also remember too, getting phone calls from Shane being on call at night. We messed something up, and that was not a crosshair you wanted to be in. It wasn't quite Vince or Stephanie, right, but you didn't want to be in that crosshair. You know, to your point about him being the closest one to the son, it's funny too, because, you know, Vince and Linda are what they are. And you look at Stephanie, and Stephanie married one of the boys, and she's been on the road, and you hear the stories about Stephanie being a party girl in college or things like that. Right.
Right.
Whereas Shane's the family man, still married to Marissa. They got their kids. He's.
Well, Shane had some wild times as a young kid too. I've heard things around Stanford. Shane had his good times.
Sure. Too. But once he got married and had his kid, like you know, he became that. Whereas, and I'm not saying Stephanie's still crazy and Triple H or whatever. I don't, you know them, but he was always more like you said, more like, you know, outside the fire. He was more Linda. So, I mean, we did get Shane at different times, but he was always more business focused, you know, and you knew what he expected. And like I said, when you ran afoul of that, the crosshairs were not fun to be in, but you understood why he was that way, siphoning up to Vince. I mean, to, you know, a point Deb made earlier too, the day Vince found out about Bite This and what it was the beginning of the end of that show as we knew it. You know, for those who watched it in the back in the day in the late 90s, early 2000s, you know, it was that underground web show, like, you know, something like we're doing now was not even remotely close to a thing in 2003. Right. And then Vince found out about it, and that's when the Matt Hardy, Lita Edge stuff all exploded. And we had to do a special episode with Lita, and Matt Hardy called in, and then Dave Lagana got involved because it became a creative thing. And then it just, you know, sort of became something completely different from what it was. You know, once Vince found out about something and got his sights on it, it was a completely different animal, because to Deb's point, it was that control of every little thing. You know, you, like you said, can you imagine Bob Iger approving a Goofy t-shirt design? Well, it's like, well, you know, he had his avatars. We had to go through the creative team for certain things or this or that. But once Vince found out about it, it went through Vince, and you didn't question it because it went through Vince. You know, I mean,
Yeah, it's very true because we would get very protective of our stuff. And, you know, you forget sometimes you're working for these people. This is not your baby here. This is theirs. You can't get too much pride of ownership. And we would make that mistake sometimes. And Deb, I see you smiling. I'm sure you guys probably had a struggle with that a lot too, because you're creating art. And then at the end of the day, you have to remember, like, we're here for this family, for this man. We're here to give them what they want. And there could be that frustration. Sometimes we would try to hide things from Shane, because we would be like, oh my God, he's going to kill this. He's going to squash this. We can't let him see it. You know, I've talked about it before. We would have on the wall, we would have what we called the map, which was all the different pages of the magazine. Lou, you walked there enough through the department to know. Sometimes Barry, my boss, the publisher, would tell us, don't put this layout on the wall. Just put it in a drawer. Don't put it up because, and we'd be like, well, that defeats the purpose of having the map. Yeah, well, if he sees it, he's going to kill the article. But a lot of that was, I felt, from working with him closely and a lot of conversations with his assistants and things, who I also was good friends with over the years, Shane was under a lot of pressure. And Shane was Vince by proxy. He had to deal with a lot of stuff from his dad. And that's when I talk about like web Shane and magazine Shane. Vince wanted Shane to be like him. And Vince would, for example, didn't like that he was so friendly to everybody and friendly to even talent, or too friendly to the people that worked for him. And so I felt like Shane very often was trying to be the way that his dad wanted him to be. And, you know, I know I'm psychoanalyzing Shane, but I was around him a lot. And so I felt like sometimes we caught the brunt of that. Sometimes I would even catch him. You would almost catch him where it was like his natural response was to be more lighthearted and easygoing. And he would restrain that and try to be a little bit more of a hard ass. Like I saw it with my own eyes. But I want to address you, Deb, because like I said, we were talking about that pride of ownership. And I don't know how much you guys had a struggle with that of, you know, we take pride in our work, but we also have to remember that this is not our stuff at the end of the day.
I still consider myself a family member. I still consider to be WWF, WWE, literally for life. So back then when you were in it, whether there was something unsavory going on, you just sucked it up because that's what it was. And then when it wasn't part of your day-to-day, I mean, when it was part of your past, I mean, years later, I think when Linda McMahon was running for office and it became, you know, really like, let's all talk about how she profited from how women were treated under her care, under her watch, and how she exploited that. And I'm like, and I wanted to be really outspoken about it too, because let's face it, you know, it's true. But at the time, I profited from it too. So I was part of that. I saw it as all part of a package of what we evolved into. And again, I started with Hulk Hogan, take your vitamins, say your prayers, you know, people wore costumes, and it evolved into, you know, the Attitude Era. And then it went into an entertainment era. So I saw it evolve so much and become as restricted as it could be over time, because, you know, again, we evolved into Me Too. We evolved into things that were, you know, no longer appropriate or, you know, lawful. It was against the law, but we all looked the other way. But again, as time went on, it's like I still feel hard to criticize Vince in that way, because I always looked up to him. I admired him. He was a god, you know. But at the same token, I'm not surprised, knowing that he's a man in a, you know, testosterone driven, you know, band of you know, people on the road, and it's a circus. It's basically it's a culture that can't be denied. It's full of monsters, and some people play by the rules and some people don't. And I think Vince was the mastermind. And again, that's a lot of unchecked power. So as much as I have, you know, love and appreciation for the whole McMahon family, it's sad that I'm not surprised at what's in the news lately. And that will, again, you know, we'll learn more as things come out, but again, nothing surprising. And again, it's, you know, I've seen this happen from the early 90s. It was, and also one last thing, Linda McMahon had a huge role, again, as I said, in the company. If you got off on the fourth floor, Vince's office was to the right and Linda's office was to the left. You know, Linda managed the company the way we looked at it. You know, she was the boss, she was mom. Vince handled things on the road. And I think if anything came up that was unsavory or, you know, needed to be kept quiet, I'm sure Linda had a very strong hand in that. But I did see things that came up that were kept quiet, that were paid off, that were unfortunate, that, you know, couldn't have been denied. So again, when I say it's no surprise, it's unfortunate, but it's not a surprise. But I will always consider myself part of that family, because I think when you go on the road with them, right?
Right.
When you've just seen them struggle, you've seen them come up, you've seen them have amazing victories where they just ate the competition up and spit them out and became, you know, king of the world. It's like you can't help but see how much power Vince McMahon held and how easy it was for anyone to fall under that spell. And again, some people are, you know, again, it's a lot of power and control that was unchecked, unfortunately.
Brian, you and I were talking the other day to that point where I mentioned how, you know, this was also a business where when you came into it, if you were closer, you know, finance is finance, IT is IT kind of thing. But when you were closer to the sun like that, you either got it or you didn't. And part of that, I think, was Vince. Like, it was the Vince way. This is how the WWF, WWE is. You either understood the business or you didn't. And that, like, I think that's why, you know, it's not just you, Dabba. It's me. I'm sure Jimmy, too, you know, despite everything. Like, it's, I don't want to call it, like, the Band of Brothers Army experience. But, like, you were in the fire. You were part of this fraternity, sorority, whatever you want to call it. You know, that you were part of the business and you understood and you were in that fire. And, you know, you'll always have that because, yeah, it was... You know, for Vince, a lot of time, it was kind of an us against the world mentality. WWE, WWF, wrestling in general was never always taken that seriously. You know, it's the lowest common denominator sport. Even my dad would joke with me when I was a kid. It's like for a sport for people that don't understand tractor pulling. And, you know, little did my dad know that 10, 15 years later, I'd be working there. But, you know, that was kind of, and Vince had his moments too. Like, I remember interviewing Vince one time for something, and I don't remember exactly what it was. It may have been around the Trump feud or whatever, where, you know, I'm doing the interview and it's in character, so I'm calling him Mr. McMahon, because again, like, God forbid you go up to a talent backstage or call them on the phone and say, you know, is the Iron Sheik there, as stupid as that sounds, right?
Yeah.
And yep. Vince, like, call me Vince, Lou. It's just me, Vince. Like, so he had his moments of not, but those were fewer and farther between, I think, for a lot of people than Vince, you know, Mr. McMahon.
Well,
hey, Brian.
Yeah.
Can I say something about something that Deb said?
Of course. Yeah, please.
I think it's very, telling, and it's very in a different sort of way. Cause, you know, listen, we could do this for 8 hours. I mean, there's so much richness here. We could do this all day, take a break, and then come back and do it tonight. You know what I mean? But I think a female in the 90s, a handsome female at that, a nice lady, she's talking very endearingly about, you know, Team McMahon and Team WWE, and that they'll always be family. And, you know, under the circumstances, I think that's very telling. And I also think that there's a part of that that probably has to do, along with my experience, has to do with Linda. You know, Linda didn't come out on the road a lot, but when she came out, you know, Linda's one of the nicest women I've ever met in my life. She made sure, you know, she knew who I was. She came up to greet me. She was the anti-Vince. She would get out of once, you know, once in a great while, she'd get out of the limo and she'd do a beeline for me and put her hand out, checking, hey, Jimmy, how you doing? How's your family? How's it? You know, that sort of thing. And to hear somebody, you know, on a podcast, you know, all these years later, you know, to be speaking about the family that is WWE. I think it's just kind of impressive in its own way. And that, yeah, Linda, and also, you know, that so Steph is a whole different, you know, Steph's a whole different beast. Then there's Linda. I also wanted to mention Shane. You know, everybody talks about Vince and, you know, the intimidation factor. And, you know, I have this story that I probably won't get to today about being in the backseat of a limo with Vince after the night before WrestleMania in Safeco Field in Seattle. And Vince and I are, you know, 1:30 in the morning in the back of a limo together. Shane was a pretty intimidating guy too. You know, Shane was Shane was of a certain size. You know, he wasn't gigantic like Vince, but he was in great shape. He must have been 6'6", 1", a good looking kid, great head of hair, you know. Big crazy personality, big smile. The whole family is intimidating AF. You know,
Shane was a handsome dude. Jimmy ain't lying. Like Shane's a good looking guy.
Shane is a good looking dude. Hey, no homo. You know what I mean? And while we're here, I'm just gonna say Stephanie. I had affinity for Stephanie. You know, Stephanie just had a way. We just kind of like we would walk past each other in the hallway for the 14th time, and we just kind of had an understanding. She'd look at me and I'd look at her, and we just understood each other. But, you know, having grown up with 7 women, one of whom is one of the more intimidating right wing figures in American politics, I will say that Stephanie is an intimidating woman herself. The whole family is very intimidating.
So the funny thing is with Stephanie, and I don't know what you guys hear or how closely you still follow things or people that you know that might still be in the company. My understanding over the years, after all the time that any of us were there, except maybe Lou, was that she kind of softened up over the years. And I don't know if it was maybe from raising children of her own or something. That will do it. I mean, unless you're Vince, that will do it. But my experience of being around her, like you guys, I agree with all of you. It was intimidating, and you wouldn't think it would be, but there was, and I'm going to say this, I'm going to take ownership of my own comments. There was an iciness in her presence. Some people I knew, not myself, but some people I knew used to call her like an ice queen. It was like there was such a difference between her and Shane. And yeah, Shane could be intimidating. Shane could be crazy. But Shane was like a knock around guy. You know, he was a guy you could let your guard down with at times and have fun with. She was not. And there would be times where they would be in a room together with other people, but you could almost feel the antipathy between them. Like it was like two opposite magnetic fields coming into contact with each other. They were so different. And I had times, and Lou, I think you probably dealt with her a lot, I guess, because of being on the road and write and filing web stories and things. But the times when I had to have sit downs with her, whether it be in her office or on the road, it was very stressful, very anxiety ridden. Like I always felt like she was looking for a reason to get you. Like she was waiting for you to say the wrong thing so she could jump on you. And that would happen sometimes. Like I remember one thing, and I'll let you talk, Lou, but a specific thing. We sat down, we had to pitch ideas a lot to these people, which was so nerve wracking because we'd be like, do we really have to do this? Can't we just pitch it to you? You know? And I remember me and another writer going in and sitting with her in her office and pitching ideas. And I think it was a holiday weekend coming up, like 4th of July or something, or Memorial Day. And I just, as we were walking out, I just said, like, have a great time with your family, you know, enjoy the holiday. And she just goes, well, I don't know about you, but I'll be working. So maybe you have a good time with your family. And I was just like, you know what? Fuck you. I'm sorry. I don't curse a lot on this show, but I didn't say that out loud, by the way. But I mean, like that kind of thing of just that wasn't called for. You don't have to talk to people that way. You know, I don't know. That's I'm off the soapbox. Lou, you were going to say
something. I mean, like that's the more she was more like Vince. Like, you know, to my point of Shane standing behind me marking out watching wrestling versus you're in a meeting with Stephanie and it's Vince. Now, I've never worked with my family, thank God, because I can barely stand being around most of them. But, you know, on TV, it's like, my dad. And, you know how the Stephanie character is, right? It was all business all the time. It was Vince. Like, never even slipped up dad or mom or my brother. It was always Vince, Linda, Shane. Like, she had that business... that tunnel vision, you know what I mean? She had that McMahon tunnel vision where business is business. And, you know, I mean, to your point about pitching ideas too, I remember one of the many times I gave up on trying to pretend I was ever going to accomplish anything of my own in the company, as you sort of said with Deb and Creative, the Heartthrobs. Remember the Heartthrobs?
My favorite tag team.
Yeah.
Michaels? No,
it was... Deuce and Domino, right? Deuce
no, that was it was no. Romeo and Antonio, the Heartthrob.
Oh, yeah. Right. Johnny Heartbreaker.
I loved them.
The two guys who were the nicest guys in the world, but inadvertently ended by this thanks to the transgender dating game, which is another story for another time. But there was one of those things. It was 4:30 on a Friday. Email goes out company wide. Everyone needs to come up with ideas. We're bringing up the Heartbreakers from OVW. We need ideas for creative this, that, like, to everybody. So Kevin Sullivan pulls us all into a room for an hour and we brainstorm stuff.
And Lou, I'm going to stop you for a quick second, just for the people that listen to this show that aren't as plugged in as us. We're not talking about Taskmaster Kevin Sullivan here. I don't want people going nuts. We're not, you know, you weren't a member of the you weren't working for the Lord of Darkness. Right. We had a web guy named Kevin Sullivan who was your boss. Just want to clear that up.
I was not in the Dungeon of Doom, but if I grow my hair out a little bit, I could at least maybe pretend to be Shark or Avalanche or whatever John Hunt's name was at that point in time.
So you were saying.
Yeah. So Kevin pulls us all in the room and we go through this thing and, you know, we whatever. All right. We have all these ideas. We send them to Stephanie at 6 o'clock on Friday night. We can go home. Thank you all for Monday. I think it was we get the email. Thank you all for all your hard work. The Heartbreakers will herefore be known as the Heartthrobs. Like, we spent an hour and a half on a fire drill on a Friday afternoon to come up with that. Like, but that's what they wanted. I don't know who suggested it or if they came up with it, but it was like one of those things like, well, you know, you can pitch an idea all you want, but don't think it's going to be your own sometimes because it's Vince and Stephanie to have the final call. So that's business. Yeah. That's what was best for business.
There was a very telling, I don't know if you guys remember when Vince would do every year, I don't know if it was beginning of the year or Christmas or something, there would be like a State of the Union address. Do you guys remember that? Where Vince
chat
would
with the chairman?
Chat with the chairman. Oh, God, yeah, yes, I blanked on the name. Chat with the chairman, where originally for years it would be held physically in a room with all the employees or whoever they could fit in there, and Vince up at the podium. Give sort of like the state of the company address, take questions from people. I went to a few of those. Eventually, as the company grew and had more locations and things, it became remote where we would do like what we're doing here, where there might be some people there present physically, but then a lot of other people were watching. And I remember one year, and this said it all to me. We watched this and we sort of were all looking at each other like, yep, that's about it. He said something like somebody asked a question about bonuses or employee recognition programs or something like that. And, you know, and he said something, Vince said something like, well, you know, my philosophy has always been the law of the jungle. And that is the way that I approach people in the company. And so if you want to get ahead, so he was basically saying that he supported this idea of just everybody ready to rip each other's throats out and turn on each other on a dime. Like, it was basically like, you know, Game of Thrones is the way that he liked it to be. Like, if you want to get ahead, well, cut the throat of the guy you work for. And that's how you get ahead. If you want to get a bonus, I'm not going to give you a bonus. You got to give me a reason to pay you more money or whatever. Yeah. So it was very much like that unchecked, you know, 19th century concept of robber baron capitalism or whatever. Like, that's how I want to run my company. And we all kind of looked at each other and we were like, Yep, that tracks. That's about the size of it. But I wanted to direct this at you too, Deb, because like I said, you're the only person here who's been on the show before. You mentioned before about, you know, it's complicated. And I want to say that it's complicated. We used to have a saying in the office. We didn't come up with this. It's been said many times about many things. For those who understand, no explanation is no. For those who don't understand, no explanation will do. For those who do understand, no explanation is necessary, or some variation of that. You either get it or you don't get it. And so it could be complicated. It wasn't the simple black and white thing all the time. Oh, no. Like when I had you on, Deb, you talked about the last time, all the Freddie Blassie stuff, right? Where Freddie took a liking to you and Freddie, you know, would flirt with you or want you to come to his office and hang out, and how it was this conflicted thing. Because on the surface, we could say, or you could say, God, looking back, that's kind of creepy. That's kind of this creepy old man thing going on. But at the same time, in the moment, it could be fun. It could be amusing. It could be funny. It was a complicated thing. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about, not necessarily that specifically, but just being, you're the only woman here on the panel, being a woman in the 90s in that company, that kind of complexity, what was that experience like?
Well, I mean, I think it wasn't only until recently that I literally looked up the statute of limitations. Like, what could people literally like claim at this point? And all I really have is my memories. And again, never bothered me. It was like a funny story that you told people that were old wrestling fans. Oh, you know, you'll never guess what I used to do with Freddie Blassie. And now that I look at it, it's like, I'm embarrassed. I'm like, I realized I was used. I was sent to his office like a little afternoon snack, like once a week. It was like I had a meeting set with Freddie to go to his office to run down the line of the card that was the live events. And there was no reason for me to do that other than to entertain him. The office right. door was closed, and he used to, you know, the very first meeting, I was, thank goodness I'm who I am. And, you know, God bless my dad. He just recently passed away. It's like, I have enough respect for myself that I was able to say, hey, look at all these really cool pictures on your wall. And he had, you know, same thing like Jimmy, floor to ceiling photos of celebrities from his golf tournaments. So I was smart enough that I knew people, was able to get him to talk about that. So I was able to stroke his ego. Otherwise, the option was, and he would say, he had a dirty old couch in that office. And he would say, oh, if I get you on that couch. And Freddie was a large man. This is 1990, 1991. So we ended up reading Playboy jokes. He read jokes out of the latest Playboy magazine to me. I got a couple of ha-has in. Then he went down the cart and I was able to leave. And back then, that was a funny part of my job responsibilities. It was harmless. Now, it would never think to do that. So again, it was a different time. This was like before Me Too. This was before sexual harassment training. This was, you know, anything goes. And when you signed up for that, because, you know, power is very enticing. And you were part of a powerful kind of, you know, juggernaut. We were growing. We were turning, you know, we weren't even in the tower at that time. We were still in two separate buildings when I had to go across the street to see Freddie. So you didn't, it's not that you didn't know enough to look the other way. You just knew that you took care of yourself and you earned their respect. And I, you know, I started the company as a pay stub artist and, you know, left there as a senior creative director. So I earned their trust, but a lot of that does have to do with Linda McMahon. And I will say it was the business culture. And then there was the road culture, you know, what goes on the road stays on the road. But in the office, Linda held a lot of power. So when we talk about elevators, you get on an elevator with Linda. There is a story, and I believe it's true. Two girls rode on an elevator with her, and she happened to ask them who the Intercontinental Champion was at the time. And both of those girls, they were probably office girls. They didn't know, and they lost their jobs. Your job is to follow along and know that brand. And we watched it. My poor kid, you know, was raised on Raw, you know, like six, 7 years old. That's what was on in my house. Raw's War. So, and then one more thing about Linda and Stephanie being like a party girl that she was, you know, after say WrestleManias or any pay-per-views, everybody goes out to a bar afterwards, or, you know, the hotel bar or whatever, and everybody wants to party, and Stephanie couldn't go because she was underage. So I got a Florida driver's license. Someone, Linda McMahon, had me recreate a Florida driver's license for Stephanie. And back then we could do it. You know, I did it on my computer. We had it laminated. It was, you know, done perfectly. And again, it's like, that's a lack of regard for rules and principles. It's like, I mean, I'm sure in a way it's harmless too. She's with her family. She wants to join them on the road. So even again, it's like, there's nothing wrong with that. She's not, you know, she's, but again, that's an example of how the rules don't really apply when you have that power. So it started back in the 90s. And as a woman, where you think it's a male dominated industry, there was a lot of powerful women in powerful positions in that office building. So, you know, don't get me wrong. When I say it's a male-dominated industry, our product was driven on testosterone or steroids and God knows what, and TNA. And you just learn how to overlook it. You learn how to talk the language with them all. My team was mostly men that worked on, like, say, retouching. So you talk about the taint or the nipple or the this or that or the pubes. You just talked about it like it was what you had to talk about. It's like work for Playboy or Penthouse. So that was our product. So to be a woman in that industry, you sort of like wall it off. And that's why it's like, you know, all the stories and the rumors and stuff that you hear, I didn't hear too much about it. It was covered up pretty easily back when I was there. But again, like everyone says, you know, what era you've worked in, everybody hears something. I bet you a lot more is going to come out.
It's a good thing you and I weren't in that elevator, Brian, because we would have probably been able to give the entire history of the Intercontinental title to that point.
Right. Exactly. The cities, the dates, the whole thing. I actually had the experience where because they had that weird thing there where you felt like they almost didn't want you to be too much of a fan. You know what I mean? They wanted you to know the product because you worked there and it was the business you were in. But if you acted like you liked it too much, that could be a problem too. So for people who were fans, yeah, Deb, you want to address that?
Again, 100%. You know, there's women you can send on the road that can do a photo shoot. And I was one of those women. So you got in there, you did your job. You didn't make a lot of issues. You didn't hem and haw. Your job was to find out where the talent was the night before. Have they eaten? Are they having any issues? To make small talk. But you get in, you get out. And then there's women that go back there and think, this is my opportunity. And you tee-hee and ha-ha and you flirt. And they always get in trouble. They always wind up losing their jobs. So whenever I do a photo shoot, someone would say, oh, I want to come with you. I'm like, oh, hell no. Because now I got to babysit your ass. No. It's like, you have to treat the talent with respect. They have a job to do. They're ogled by their fans. You're not a fan. You're there to get a job done, especially when you're backstage. And that's what separated a lot of women from the ones that lasted and got the job done and got respect, and the ones that didn't last. So there was, again, a lot of powerful women in that business. Don't get me wrong, and they're the ones that handled the talent the right way. They're just people, you know. They're just people. You don't ask to get your photo taken with them. You know, there's special circumstances, yes, but that's a huge part of it.
Jimmy can, I know Jimmy can definitely speak to this, but you and I spoke about this too, Brian. That there was that thing that depending on who you worked for and where you were on the road too, like, you were either one of them or you weren't. Like, yes. You know, for me, for a while, it was, those are Shane's guys. That's Cole's boy, because Michael Cole was our boss for a while. So, like, all right, the guys knew Cole wasn't going to let us do anything that was going to compromise the industry. So .com was fine for that time because those are Cole's boys. You know, and everybody, you know, Cole was a little bit of a whipping boy on the road, too. I mean, he worked with JBL for God knows how long, so... you know, even I think if I saw JBL today, he'd still say, hey, what's up, fat boy? Cause that's how I was referred to, but you were either one of them or you weren't. And that's, you know, to Depp's point, it's like sometimes maybe, especially being a woman, you know, that's your in with these big macho guys, like it's the industry and you do your thing. And then there were people that just went in and did their jobs and got in and got out and that's all it was. And, you know, some people needed more of that being one of them than others. For us, it was helpful for our job because we got a little bit more access knowing that, you know, this guy knows I'm not going to expose the business, you know, or whatever, kind of what happens on the road stays on the road. So it was definitely that dynamic too, where, oh yeah, that's one of us. Like, you know, I think I told you the story about the WrestleMania 23 elevator where things changed with me and a talent that was kind of icy to me for a while because of who they were. And then I saw them in a semi-compromising position, and the person they were with knew me because I was one of them, and everything changed. Like, that's right. What it was, you know?
Ryan, another way of saying what was just said is, so you got three people on your, not including you, your three guests. We have over 30 years between us with the company. So it's a significant 30 years of experience at WWE. Two things. If you were a mark, you weren't going to last. You know, the big word, the mark. If you were a mark, and if you were an asshole, you were going home. So the three of us, it could probably be said, it could probably be agreed, we're not marks, and we're definitely not assholes. If anybody's an asshole, I'm the biggest asshole because I was put in the asshole position. You know, I had to... I had to play a role. I had to be kind of a tough guy in a world full of tougher guys, you know, and it was kind of difficult. There's only one thing that I wanted to add to what's been said recently, and it's going back like a conversation and a half to something Deb said. And it's when you're on the road, like, so for me on the road, okay, I'd be walking around an arena in Arkansas, in Peoria, in Seattle, you know, in Tampa, and I'd be doing my rounds. I'd just be doing my, you know, 10-hour, 12-hour pre-show stuff. And somebody come up to me and said, Michael Hayes wants to see you. Okay. I go find Michael Hayes. And then, Johnny wants to see you. Johnny Laurinaitis wants to see you. Eh, you know, no big deal. Kevin Dunn wants to see you. Okay. That'll get your attention a little bit. Vince wants to see you. Vince wants to see me? Wow, that doesn't happen very often. The only time your tentacles would really go up is when somebody would walk up to you and say, Stephanie wants to see you. And then you'd go, oh, shit. Isn't that funny? Out of all those people, Kevin Dunn, ba-ba-ba-da-beep, ba-ba-ba-da-boop, Vince McMahon, the only one that I would have my oh, holy shit moment was when somebody would say, Stephanie wants to see you.
You know, this is true. And I feel like this is becoming like the Attack Stephanie McMahon show. And
no!
But you're correct, is what I'm saying. You are right. When you said that, it's like, I never really thought about it. But when you laid that out, I said, God, yes, that is so true. Like, I knew, again, to the point of what Lou was saying, too, is like, sometimes you could be protected on the road, like some of it, during the period where the .com guys, they worked for Michael Cole, or like we worked for Shane McMahon, and people knew that if they knew who you were and they knew who you worked for, okay, they may not mess with you in that situation because it would get back to Shane. And it did. There were situations where people would mess with some of us and they would get disciplined in at least one case, even fired for doing that kind of stuff. I'm talking about talent. But by the same token, that could also compromise you. So like, because we worked for Shane, in some cases, I felt like automatically Stephanie didn't like us because we worked for Shane. Yeah. And, you know, I don't want to bring in names of people who aren't public figures and who aren't here and who may not want all their stories out. But like, I knew at least one case of a person I worked with as a writer on my team, who I was very close with and good friends with, who went out on the road, got on Stephanie's bad side, and wound up getting fired for stupid things that weren't even that bad, that they should have never been fired for. But it was like this weird tug of war between Stephanie and Shane, this like power play thing. Deb, you were going to say something.
Yeah, that's why I'm no longer with the company. In 2005 was when they started bringing Stephanie up into a more creative role. She had a lot of power. Instead of my going directly to Vince like I'd always had, I would go to Stephanie first. Stephanie would approve something. I would take it up to Vince. Vince didn't like it. Then I'd go back down and we'd try something else. So it was Stephanie was growing. She looked at our creative group and she started like hacking away. And we lost like eight principal people. And she brought in people from agencies. She wanted like a a night team. It was like, okay, you know, let's give creative to Stephanie. So again, I was, that's when I was let go. But again, she had, you know, as a young girl, I remember Stephanie said she was like maybe 12. She was a girl of privilege and she could have done anything with her life. She could have gone to, you know, anywhere and done anything, but she grew up in the industry and she chose to be part of the industry. She married into the industry. She had that choice and she chose to, and she's, again, she's a product of that monster. I mean, I remember when she got a boob job at a very young age, it was like, that was so unnecessary, but she was on the road with divas all the time and she had to compete. And then I remember being backstage when she was with Hunter and China was still, I think, transitioning out of that, you know, storyline in reality. And I think as part of the show. And again, it was like Stephanie just came up and she had to wield power to be respected, to hold that position that she chose to have in that business. And Shane was smart, in my opinion, to step out. Because I think, you know, especially when, you know, when she aligned herself with Triple H, or, you know, at the time, I think that really solidified her. She you can see where she wanted that power. Kids do mellow you. And yes. God knows what else in her life has mellowed her. But again, I will put my two cents in as far as Stephanie. I respect her, but I see where her taste for power was really easily fed by the monster that was or is the WWE, WWF at the time.
Well, I kind of wish I knew the mellow Stephanie.
I know, I hear about this now and I'm just like, boy, I would like to be around her now. Because no, I've heard this from a lot of people in the company in recent years who will say to me, listen, trust me, she is not the same person that you remember from back then. She's a much more compassionate, understanding person now. I'm not saying she's an angel or anything, but she's changed. That's what people keep telling me. And now I just want to say, you know, with the Hunter and Stephanie thing too, because we weren't on the road constantly, we would get rumors and things would come off the road or somebody would be out there and would come back with stories and things. So we started getting like the rumblings of this storyline with Hunter and Stephanie being married on TV or being together. It may not just be a storyline. And we were like, wait a minute, but, and I don't think people realize this. Paul was engaged to Joanie. They weren't just an item. They were engaged. Joanie China was showing off her rock. All right. She had a ring on her finger. Do you remember that, Deb?
We had filmed the, a Super Bowl commercial. Yes. I remember our big Super Bowl commercial. And I remember being in a scene in the lobby where I think Joanie had Triple H or Triple H had Joanie. One, she had somebody in a headlock with her legs. And I saw that ring. And that's. And again, one quick thing I want to throw you off, but about Joanie is, you know, here's a woman who changed herself so dramatically because of the industry. Like, it was so important to look that way. Again, like, that's another sign of how completely awash it was in that male dominant, you know, you should look pretty, your jawline should be different. And she did that for Vince because of his power, because of basically, right? Because he had the power over her career.
And I think she also did it for Hunter too. I think there was I want to be right. I want to be what he wants, that kind of thing. And I remember
but again, like getting a boob job, it's like, you know, for Steph, it's like, you know, it's like as a woman, like, oh, come on, you're so beautiful. You know, you're so real. It's like for all of the women that you would see backstage, it's like they were so not real, but that was their choice. And I think it's, again, it was the 90s, you know, it was divas, swimsuits and gowns. It was insane.
But it's come a long way. No, it has. And actually, I just quickly want to say, too, I find it very refreshing today with the women that they have as female talent wrestlers, yes, that they don't always feel compelled to get these crazy boob jobs and things that they sometimes even realize this is going to get in the way of my work. I'm not going to be as good of a performer with these giant friggin' things hanging off my chest. You see some of them now that opt not to do that. It still happens. They still, but there's many of them that just choose not to because there's maybe less of pressure. But I want to say quickly about the Hunter and Stephanie thing is one of the things that we'd be getting these rumors and things of what's really going on. We did a feature. We would do this thing. It was almost like MTV Cribs, except it was in print form. I forget what it was called. We would go to the homes of the superstars and take pictures and hang out. And we went to Triple H's house. And I was not there. I heard this secondhand from the people who went. And they said it was just him who was home. We went in the house. We were doing the setting up all the lights and the cameras and things. And we noticed by the couch, next to the couch, there was a pair of Hunter's shoes. They were clearly like his, you know, men's sneakers or shoes or whatever. And next to them were this kind of sort of dainty kind of pair of women's sneakers. And, you know, could be completely harmless. But I remember people saying, like, those are not Joni's sneakers. She's a big girl. Those are somebody else's shoes. And we started going like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe there's something to this. And then the next thing you hear is everything that everybody else knows. Yes, they're together. Yes, China is fired because she, quote unquote, wanted too much money and all that kind of thing. And but like we were already getting the vibe of what was going on well before that.
It's so sad. So sad.
Yeah. Yeah,
me and Joni didn't get along.
Tell us about that. Because I will say, I'll just say, yes, there were, you know, I know that, you know, she's passed now and everything, and there's a lot of tragedy to her story, but I did hear things about her being difficult with some people in the company.
There's another level to the story too, aside from the one I was going to say, which was just that we didn't get along. The other thing is I was doing, Bruce Pritchard lost his co-host on Something to Wrestle With. Is that the name of his podcast?
Yeah.
And about 10 years ago, I don't can't really remember. You'll tell me because you'll figure this out in a second. And I get on when, oh, so I go, hey, Bruce, you know, I've done Monday Night Mayhem. I won a couple of awards. I said, I do my own podcast. I go, you want to hook up? He goes, you know the format? Yeah, let's do it. About the second show, we had great show, second great show, third great show. And then I get on the show one day and I say, oh, I got some news. And he said, what's that, Jimmy? I said, oh, Joni Laura's doing porn. And he said, what? I said, Joni Laura's doing porn. He said, what are you, Jimmy? He was like, he was baffled. He was, is this from a credible? Like, you just can't say that. I go, dude, I just got a call from the guy. I have friends in the porn business. When you're in WWE and you go to California on a regular schedule, a lot of the people sitting at ringside are porn people. They become your friends when you're the head of security. That they're sitting right there, they become your friends. And a guy called him. He goes, hey, I just knocked out your friend Joni. I go, what are you talking about? He goes, I did a scene with Joni. I go, Joni LaChina? He goes, yeah, I did a porn scene. He says, oh yeah, she's doing like this, you know, heavy duty, you know, I'm not going to describe it, but heavy duty porn thing. And then Joni, it came out in the news. Bruce, I think I got fired by Bruce. I think Bruce was like, that was too much. We couldn't prove it, you know? And then of course, 6 months later, you know, and she denied it. And she mentioned me by name in all the print, you know, that somebody said, But of course it was true. I never would have said it if it wasn't true.
How could she deny it if the video is out? I mean, that's
because it wasn't out. She had just shot the day before.
Okay.
I had inside information that nobody was supposed to get. Even Vivid called me and said, how'd you get that information? I go, dude, I know people. Anyway, I always felt bad about that because that was the beginning. I'm not saying I had anything to do with that, but you know what I mean? I put her in a bad spot, but it was the truth. I mean, I was just being like I was kind of being a journalist. Anyway, I just want to say that. But Joni, when I came on, it was kind of the tail end of the Hunter. You know, Stephanie was already involved. And remember, I spent my most of my first year and a half at WWF New York working with the talent. I wasn't quite out on the road yet.
That's right. Yes.
Okay. I'd go out once in a great while, but she was coming in and she just had absolute contempt for security. She said in her book that she compared WWE security to the way she said it was, think about your local school crossing guards on the street by your house. That's the way she talked about WWE. She had complete contempt for us. She didn't like any of us. When she wore her boots, you know, with the big heel on them, she was about 2 inches taller than all of us. You know, we were all like 6'1", 6'2", 6'3". She just did not like me. And I don't think I said 10 words to her the whole time. You know, she was somebody you just stayed away from. You just stayed away from Joni. She was always in a bad mood, but you know, we didn't know what she was going through, but I don't think in any life we would have become friends.
Deb, you wanted to respond to that.
Just on that point though, honestly, Jimmy, you said it. It's like, who would be in a good mood if you had to show up and do your job under those circumstances?
Yeah, no joke. With
those watchful eyes on you, and it just that's a lot. I don't see how she couldn't have been driven to what she did. It's sad. Anyway, but
I think it's especially
being in a bad mood.
It's tough for the female talent. I feel like now, again, I'm not there now. None of us are there now, but. You know, I can see how it's becoming a much more, or it seems on the surface, you know, a locker room where there's more women than ever. I think one of the problems was, and this was briefly mentioned at the beginning, is when you have a world where the locker room traditionally in wrestling was 100% men, 100%, you know, every now and then in terms of, and I'm talking about even before the Vince days. I mean, there used to be an old adage in the business, even, that a woman in the locker room was bad luck, almost like on like a ship at sea or something, you know. And that over the decades has changed a whole lot, where it's become more welcoming. But in the beginning, let's say from a talent point of view, when you started introducing more women into the situation there in the 90s, let's say, it's not shocking that it would be this explosive, salacious thing, because you know, of the type of environment that it is, it would be natural that all of a sudden everybody was going to start, to be totally frank, you know, jumping into bed with each other. I mean, it's not a shocking thing. And I think maybe now that we're a generation or two removed from it, it's become more like, oh, this is just my job now. This is just, it's more expected that there's going to be male and female talent here and they're going to be more protected. Maybe it's wishful thinking on my part, but that's the feeling I get now, that things in that area are definitely improving.
One could argue, Brian, that the night that WWE's WrestleMania main event was a female match, everything changed at the locker room at that moment, and probably sometime before that became equal, you know, that it wasn't all the guys and a few women, that right. The women had earned their keep. The women are making millions now. You know, when we were doing house shows in the, you know, in the early 2000s, it would be, you know, 35 dudes and Nydia, Ivory, Keebler, Dawn Saltis, and Mickey James. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like five women. And it was like every night, and every night would be a bikini match. I'm like, oh my God, you're killing me, guys. You know what I mean? How many times I gotta see Stacey Keebler's ass, as beautiful as it is. You know what I mean? You're killing me. I think it looks to me, I mean, I don't know the product, you know, I mean, I know who this Rhea Ripley is and Becky the Man and all that stuff, but most of these people, I don't know who they are, but you can just see it on TV that they're equal now. It's almost like they're equal.
And there's also the sense in some cases that, it, you know, you mentioned Rhea Ripley and people like that. I mean, some of these women now are more valuable as talent, because look, The women, either in the old days, the women were like a sideshow. They were an afterthought. And then the women just became sort of like a TNA kind of lurid, like, oh, we're going to look at their bodies. Whereas now they really feel like a very these are valuable talents. Rhea Ripley is more over than 90% of the men in professional wrestling. Absolutely. Right now. Things like that. I mean, like, that has changed. Deb, you were going to say something. And then I think, Lou, you wanted to say something, too. So first Deb, then Lou.
Just on that note, 100%. It's like, this is post-Me Too. I don't know if this factors in or not, but these are independent contractors, to my understanding. So I don't think there's really anybody looking out for them, for their interests. So I think they really have to really be, you know, looking out for themselves, being strong. And again, these are powerful women that worked this the right way and are making it work for them, and more power to them. I'm like, I'm loving the direction that it's finally come. And I love to see that they're dominating now. And that makes me happy after, you know, 30 some odd years. It's like, look where we've come. So again, it's this is post Me Too. This is the direction that we're going. But what's incredible when you consider how that movement has grown, what was going on behind the scenes the whole time, which is insane, which was going on that whole time. So it just goes to show you, this kind of all factors in on one person or one family, one dynamic, that culture that we can't forget about. But it is a good thing to see that, despite that, we were able to see a lot of growth in that woman's evolution as part of the brand, as part of the business. So I applaud that. It's cool.
No question. And Lou, what were you going to say?
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, for my run, the end of Jimmy's runs, part of your run, you know, there's the two things you worried about around WrestleMania season were who's going to face Taker and which diva is going to pose next in Playboy. That was their kind of, like, it's kind of weird to walk around. I can only imagine what it was like for them, but it's kind of weird for me as a, you know, mid-20s dude walking around backstage. Oh, hey, there's Maria. Yeah, I saw her tits in a magazine. Great. Like, you know, it's, I can only imagine what it's like for those ladies, you know, or Ashley, you know, God rest her soul, and some of the things she had to deal with. But now, you know, a lot of these performers, you know, it started with Ronda and Shayna coming from the world of UFC. Natty's been in the business, you know, her whole life by proxy with her family. So is Charlotte. You know, Tiffany Stratton now looks like she's going to be a humongous star. She's at one of those NIL signings, was like a gymnast. You know, Casey Catanzaro coming from American Ninja Warrior and having that athletic background. A lot of these women that are now getting to the top of the card are, you know, I don't want to say legitimate athletes, because that delegitimizes women like Trish and Lita and those who kind of paved the way as, you know, the current brand of divas that became wrestlers. But, you know, these are women that are strong, powerful, athletic. They're not just, I'm here to show my tits for Playboy, make $1 million and fade into the sunset. They're part of the show. They're an important part of the show. Jimmy mentioned WrestleMania 35, where, I mean, you know, unfortunately you had to sit through 7 hours of show to watch Becky versus Ronda versus Charlotte, right? But now it's more of a, now they're more of the athletic spectacle and the athletes and the, than just, you know, yes, Stacy Keibler is still gorgeous and wonderful and would still look great in a bikini match, but that's not their forte anymore. That's not what the product is, especially being geared towards kids so much now with the G rating and more of the family friendly atmosphere. It's kind of tough to have, you know, your female talent posing for Playboy and going out there in skimpy outfits when you're trying to present this image. They've now moved more to this, you know, like you said, the Rias and the Beckys, and, you know, especially the second generation, third generation people like Charlotte and Natty and all that. So it's great to see how far that's come, because, I mean, the Becky Lynch storyline is great right now. The Bayley damage control storyline is just as huge as Cody Roman in terms of its place on the card, because it's when did they come back? SummerSlam of 2022? That group came back, Brian, and now it's WrestleMania 2024, and we're getting that explosion. Like, it's, they're just part of the show now, as opposed to the divas, which is,
and not only that. The ironic thing is, and I know I don't normally talk about current wrestling too much on this show, but the reality is, and who would have ever thought this coming? I cover the whole industry for a variety of reasons. So all the different major companies I'm following. WWE, of all people, WWE is the company that is handling women possibly the best, handling female talent the best. You can make a case for TNA, I think, or Impact Wrestling doing that, but they definitely have it all over All Elite Wrestling in terms of how women are showcased, how women are presented, how they're taken seriously. And I never would have imagined that coming from this company, with all due respect, the way that it's been done in the past, where it almost seemed like it was just a big rib in a way. The way that the women were presented, it was almost like for the pleasure, not just of the fans, but of the boys. And now it has become something so different. And I'm wondering, I don't work there anymore, none of us do, but I'm wondering what the corporate culture is like today. I'd be very curious to get a sense of what it's like working there now. Not looking for a job, but just
speculating. I mean, it was definitely a lot different even in 2020, Brian. So, I mean, it's, you know, I was only in the office and very rarely at that because we were kind of sequestered away in our own spot, but things were different. Things were definitely different around the office culture. And part of that is, you know, I think we had 5 different pieces of real estate when I left in 2020 between, you know, it was the tower in 120 Hamilton for the longest time. And then they expanded to 88 Hamilton. And then they had space across the street at 1266. And then they had the little enclave in Harbor Drive where we were for the network. And then there was New York. And there was so much. Everybody was so separated that, you know, you had to be a little bit more professional at times because there was a lot less, you know, closeness.
Yeah.
But they are in a state of flux as far as like being disjointed. And as far as leadership, they've gone through so many different, you know, who's in charge, who's in, who's out. Vince's story has been in and out of there every day. So I am curious to see how they evolve. And I believe they don't have Linda McMahon at the helm. I don't really know
who's
at the helm.
She's gone.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. So again, it's like, I'm curious to know what it's like too. And I do have, you know, friends on the inside that I will feel them out because I am curious, especially to see where it settles into as they move into their new headquarters and things change. Cause this is definitely a time of flux for that. Corporate family.
And I think they finally have everybody under that building now. I know from following friends of, you know, longtime friends that 120 Hamilton has kind of been vacated now. And then the little building that used to be Titan Tots is vacated now. And so I think just about everybody is downtown in the giant building. So yeah, maybe everybody's together now where it's pretty darn close to it.
And I think the environment of today, too, with it being now bought out by a giant corporation and now it's part of TKO with UFC and they're under Endeavor Group and all this. And you have these people, even before Vince was out, like above Vince had a boss. I mean, Vince had a boss for the first time since his father was alive, you know, and I have to imagine that. These are people who are going to have very limited patience with the bullshit, carny nonsense of the pro wrestling business, you know? And I almost feel at times that if there is some kind of like initial buyer's remorse, not saying they're going to dump it or anything, of being like, what the hell did we get ourselves into? He did what to who, what, and when? You know what I mean? Like these people who are just not used to the world of wrestling are most likely going to really clamp down on this sort of thing going forward, you know, because these are people that are all about the bottom line, man. It's like whatever endangers that has got to go, you know what I mean? And so I'm imagining too, that has got to influence the corporate culture as well. And the culture on the road too, because the thing about the corporate culture was, and for those of us that were in that office a lot too, the mindset of the road would bleed directly into the office as well. I mean, there was a kind of a free-for-all mentality to things sometimes. I used to call it the human resources nightmare. It's just like that would be the worst job in the world to be to work in human resources for WWE. We would just say and do things that you would never even dream of saying or doing in any other office desk job, you know?
It was absolutely bullshit carny nonsense. That sums it all up. Bullshit carny nonsense, 100%.
You know, it was like the fraternity mentality, and at times it could be a lot of fun. I said the other side of it's the most fun I ever had in any job in my life and probably will ever have. But, you 100%. Know, a lot of that stuff is just not tolerated, you know, in the normal world, right? I mean, Lou, I think you wanted to say something about that, or did you not?
No, I was just saying you were absolutely right with the carny line. I mean, that's I agree with Jimmy said something way earlier. Not as much as he did, but I saw the United States of America in one Canadian city on Vince's dime, and I can't complain. And I've seen the inside of some seedy places with some of Vince's employees on Vince's dime. And I wouldn't trade it for the world, but you know, it definitely, I can tell you one thing. If people think that their jobs are hard when it comes to, you know, white collarish jobs, you know, I'm not going to compare what we do to ditch diggers and railroad employees and people that lay their blood, sweat and tears on the line every day. But, you know, if you think tax season is a grind, work a WrestleMania week or six and then let me know how you feel.
Yeah.
Especially on the road where there is nothing else to do but work.
Yeah, and I know we talked about from the beginning, I think it was Lou or somebody who mentioned the whole Band of Brothers thing and the thing of the complicated nature of it, which is what I feel like I do have this sense that I never got or get from any other job I've ever had. And it's weird. It's like I don't know if it's PTSD or whatever it is, but it's this sense of we were all in this together. It's like veterans of a war. You know, it's like a VFW or something when you see sometimes to this day, former employees get together or have social gatherings and things and different groups, different cliques or whatever the case may be. That just doesn't happen with other jobs. You know, I came to WWE not right out of college, but about 3 years out of college. I didn't have tons of work experience and I came to work there and I came to think like, oh, every job is like this. Every job is like this where, you know, it was like being in the mob. We would go to each other's social functions and family functions. I would have my coworkers' kids at my kids' birthday parties and things. Like, it was like Goodfellas, you know, and then I go to other jobs later and be like, oh, other jobs aren't like this. It was just that job, you know. So there is that thing that I think no one will ever really understand if you weren't there.
Well,
I don't know if it's, you know, post-traumatic stress disorder, but it's probably the next closest thing on the list of you know, people say, well, what did you do? I said, I was head of security for WWE. They said, well, what does that mean? I said, I was head of security for the biggest traveling juggernaut in the history of man. Okay. Well, what did you do there? I did everything. Well, what did you specifically do there? Doesn't matter what I did. I wore 15 hats. Rich Herring to this day has no idea what I did on the road, how many hats I wore, exactly what I did. Nobody, maybe Johnny Laurinaitis would understand, maybe one or two of the wrestlers who cared in that moment. But it's 15, 16 years later, on a weekly basis, I dream about WWE. It's not because it was so big in my life. It's just that it was so sensational and so big, and the characters and the airplanes and the airports and the rental cars and the divas and the wrestling and the blood and the lights and the crowds. What the fuck? You know what I mean? Of course I'm going to dream about it. It was huge. And it wasn't because I was a mark, it's because I was thrown into this situation. It was very serendipitous. I tell a story in Getting Color about you know, the or the one man show I did last year about the way it happened. I'm laying in bed one night with my girlfriend. I lived with Lainey for about 7-8 years. One of the loves of my life. We never got married. And it's about 1990. It's about 1996. And we're laying in bed one night and I can't sleep. I turn on the TV and she's sleeping. And I turn on wrestling. And there's this guy named Stone Cold and a guy named Bret Hart, and they're in this ring, and they're just the blood's flying out of Stone Cold's head, and all this crazy chairs, and Mick Foley's falling. Oh my God, this crazy stuff is going on. And I wake up, I said, Lainey, away. She goes, what? She looks and she goes, oh, wrestling. Oh, I go, wait, Lainey, look at that guy over there. She said, look at him in the corner. She goes, who, the bald guy who looks like you? I go, no, the guy right behind him in the corner. And I pointing at Jim Dotson. I find out later I'm pointing at Jim Dotson. I see this guy, arms and the black tango leather cap backwards, and just standing there, kind of doing his thing. And I said to Lainey, I'm going to do that job someday. She goes, what? I said, see that guy? I'm going to do that job someday. She goes, you're an actor. What are you going to? I said, I'm going to do that job someday. 3 years later, I was doing it. Okay, how weird is that? So you talk about serendipity. So there was obviously something in me having to do with this, you know, this wrestling energy, even though I never wanted to be a wrestler. I never wrestled. I never watched it. I was never a fan. If anything, I watched WCW for a little while. I watched Sid Vicious and NWO and all that stuff. But it affected me. It affected me on a cellular level so much that all these years later, on a weekly basis, I still dream, and Steph will be in a dream, or Trips will be in a dream, or Billy Gunn and Chuck Palumbo coming out, or the Heartthrobs, you know, they'll be in a dream. John D'Amico, Mark Yaton, you know. Do the cameraman, like, they'll just pop up in a dream. That's how much it affected me. That's what WWE does to you. Why? I don't know.
It's
intoxicating.
It is. Jimmy, I you summed the entire experience up in the most succinct and eloquent way. I've been doing this friggin' show for over 2 years trying to say what you just said in the last minute. So I mean, that was perfect. And I mean, all of this was perfect. I know we went long. I knew it was gonna go long. I'm also very glad that this was the batch of people that I got together to do this. I have a feeling I'm gonna be doing more of these, but to be the first time doing this, this was outstanding. And the idea of bringing people from different walks of life within the company together and everybody just gelling and talking again, it's like that thing, we were all in this together, even though, you know, we did totally different things. It doesn't matter. I mean, this was great.
Brian, I can tell you, awesome. I can tell you that I have three things from WWE that in my life that encapsulate the entirety of the weirdness of the experience. I have a person who I was his and he was mine, best man at our weddings. I have a signed Playboy by one of the hottest chicks I used to fawn over in my life. That was a coworker. And I have allegedly a piece of the Pentagon that was breached on 9/11. If that doesn't sum up the entirety of the bizarre experience of working at WWE, along with Jimmy's statement, I don't know if anybody can other than the two of us.
Well, I have a pair of the Million Dollar Man's breakaway pants in my storage room here in my basement, which is definitely an icebreaker. And yes, I have worn them a couple of times. Yes.
Are they black or the green ones?
They're the black and purple with the black with the purple stripe down the side. I have a pair of those. They were clearing out a storage room. The craziest damn thing. And they're just like, hey, you want this? I'm like, what the hell? Yeah, sure. Of course.
Are we showing our markness now?
I guess we are.
And I have a signed Eddie Guerrero.
Oh, Eddie, yes. Oh, wow.
That was a tough day.
One of the darkest days. I don't give a crap what anybody says. One of the darkest days in WWE history. And the worst part is, and God bless you, Eddie, number one. But one of the worst parts is the next day we had to leave for 14 days to Europe.
That's right.
And I couldn't say goodbye to my friend. It was fucking heartbreaking, bro. We had to go to Europe. And I said to Johnny Layfield, I said, John, Eddie's gone. Why are we going on this trip? Are you kidding me? He goes, we can't cancel shows. I go, John, it was Eddie Guerrero. He's dead. I can't go to my buddy's funeral. I rode with Eddie, you know? And he said, Jimmy, we got 40,000 people in Stuttgart tomorrow night. We can't cancel. I was like, well, I just can't believe this. I finally 3 years ago, got to Eddie's grave. I flew to Phoenix and I got to sit with Eddie and say goodbye to him. One of the darkest days in WWE history. I'll never forget it. In the 2 weeks in Europe, when you come around the corner, as much heat as Dave Bautista and Booker T had, and you're in Europe, and let's say you're in Köln, or you're in Stuttgart, or you're in Munich, and you walk around a corner, and Dave Bautista and Booker T are hugging each other and crying because their comrade is gone and we didn't get to go to his funeral. I'll just never forget that. And it's the one thing I'll never forgive WWE for. I'll never forgive them for that.
I was the one in the office that day receiving all the .com stuff for that. That was...
I remember hearing that and I know there was that big tour, and I know a lot of people didn't get to go to the service, and that I do remember hearing about that and the awful
Dean
timing.
Dean Malenko, JBL, Chavo, and Ray. That's who we left back, and they met us like 4 days later in Europe. Horrible.
And Lou, we were getting that stuff too back, you know, in the photo department publications, just horrible. Mm-hmm. Just pictures of everybody crying and just the things you don't want to, you know, have to look at as part of your job. You know, we're editing photography of people crying because their friend died. You know, it was.
Listen, the next night or 2 nights later, I go out before the show. The show's going to start in 3 minutes, and I kind of enter, and I didn't know there were so many. I didn't know it wasn't a stadium, but I didn't know it was an indoor arena that held like over 30,000 people. And maybe we were in Munich, maybe we were in Berlin, or maybe we were in Rome. I don't really remember. That's how bad it was. And, you know, big fucking tough security guys coming out for the show, and everybody knew me, and everybody kind of always waited for me. And the people at ringside would, you know, say things to me. And up in the rafters, it was so big, like 25, 30 people were holding this sign. And way up in the 300 section, there was a sign. So I make my entrance, not my entrance, but I enter. And I see the sign, Eddie, please do a frog splash from heaven. And I just, in front of everybody, I'm out at the ring. I look up, Eddie, please do one last frog splash from heaven. And I almost fell down. I stood and I bent over and I sobbed in front of 30,000 people. And I was so embarrassed, but I was so broken. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to make this about me now. I went over, you know, he was saying, you know, what do you have? I got, you know, Eddie, and I said, I got to show my, and then of course I went to Eddie Guerrero, but yeah, just, it was just horrific. Sorry to end on such a shitty note. Ugh.
No. Hey, thanks for bringing everything down at Jimmy. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You can count on Noonan.
It was horrible. No question. Deb, did you have something you want to say about that? I know everybody's got stuff to do. Like what we said, we could do it for 8 hours. I think we are going to do it for 8 hours. Deb,
we totally could.
Two things quick. Actually, I was in the office the day after Owen died. I remember I got the call. While the pay-per-view was on, from someone that was watching it. They said, are you watching it? And then I remember I called my boss and I was like, are you watching it? And then, so I remember what the office was like the next day. And that just really hits home what a family you were, whether you worked, you know, at any level in the office, all the way up to the ring crew. It's like when you lose someone like that, it really hit home to all of us. It was horrifying. I remember I had a call. I had to call a local florist to put a flower arrangement together to be sent up to, I think it was in Calgary or something, with his yellow and black colors, I think, at the time, to represent him. And I think we put a WWF logo in the center of it. And the story was, when it got there, I think his widow took the WWF branding off of the floral arrangement, which I think makes sense.
Yes.
You know, considering, but that's like you were part of a family. When something like that happened, we have to end this on a higher note, guys.
he was wearing the "I look like a road sign" tights from the DX Does the Nation, right? He was wearing the caution tape style.
Right.
Yeah, yellow and black were his colors. Yeah.
I started there 9 months after that happened. And even 9 months later, the people that I worked with, you know, most of them were there at that time. His name wouldn't even be mentioned, not because of any, you know, because if you did, people would just start crying. Just people could not even talk about it.
We had to take pay-per-view poster off the wall. Pay-per-view poster. I think it was called Over the Edge. And we were told to strip it. Like, it never went out. I think it might have gone out for circulation, but you'll never see a poster hung in the building because it was just too sensitive. I think it featured Undertaker. It was called Over the Edge. I want to end on a high note. My experience that kind of mirrors what Jimmy was saying about falling in love and being captivated by the company was when I worked at the first fan festival, which I think was 1991 or 92. And being in the art department at the time, I was backstage behind curtains blowing up helium balloons. And as people came in, this, I think it was at Madison Square Garden, and you hand balloons to fans. And I remember prior to it starting, you really realize I'm part of show business. And yes. I remember Bob Collins. Remember Bob Collins, Mr. Show Business, Mr. WrestleMania?
Bob Collins, the nicest SVP in that entire company by a country mile. Yes.
Shout out to Bob Collins. Shout out to Bob. Mr. WrestleMania, 100%. He addressed us all as a team, and he said, you know, before this opens, you're part of something. You're part of show business. And I think that's the thing that, you know, you get a taste of that, you realize I'm part of something special. It was my first job really out of college, too. So you grew up in it. You learn to accept things. This is the crazy, carny road show. You know, you learned what kayfabe meant. And you just kind of knew, you know, went on the road, stays on the road. And as a woman, you learn how to make smart choices and you survived. And I, again, that's when I say I can look at the company now and kind of shake my head and, you know, it's too bad. But the same token, you know, it was the greatest job I've ever had. You know, we were part of a promotional powerhouse, and, you know, every month it was a new pay-per-view, and now it's even more so. I have so much respect for what they do now over there. But again, I come from, 30 years ago or more. So everything's changed. I hope it's for the better. And I know I'm really happy that one positive thing you can say about the company, considering all the Vince backlash right now, is women are really, you know, getting their day and really shining as rightful, you know, top tier players in that game. So more power to them. I'm really happy to see that. So
we should. And I'll close it with an experience that I had with that whole idea of like, wow, I am in show business. We are in show business. I will never forget. If you remember, for those that were there, I think we were all there at the time when they put together that montage video with the Kid Rock song, The Lonely Road of Faith, where it was like the entire history of the company up to that point, 2001, 2002. And it was everything, you know, from the 70s, 80s, 90s to that song. And it was very an emotional thing. It was a very like poignant, almost in a way, summary of the whole company. And they started playing that video after it was used on TV. They would play it at all the shows before TV started, or at the house shows. They would play it before the show started just to like get the crowd in the mood. And I distinctly remember this one time I'm on the road, which I wasn't always. I'm on the road. I'm walking backstage, just walking along with my little notepad and my little recorder. And the song is playing out in the arena and you could hear it. And I'm walking through and I'm looking to my left and Dustin Rhodes is there, Gold Dust, putting his makeup on, looking in a mirror. You know, there was Batista's over here. He's like putting on his knee pads. I mean, they got the magic guys with the, you know, putting the props together with the big containers and guys setting lights up. And I'm going, this is it. I'm in my little way. I am in this show. I am in the world of show business. I am in this world, and I'm seeing things that there are people that would give an arm to be able to see and experience. And that moment really crystallized it for me. So I'll wrap it up with that, because I know we could go for hours and hours, and I'm going to, out of courtesy to everyone's needs, I'll bring it to a close. But Deb, Jimmy, Lou, thanks all of you. We've set a standard here. Thanks all of you for being a part of this very special episode for me. I can't thank you enough.
Awesome. Anytime.
This was great. This was thank so you, much brother. Fun. Yeah, thank
good
you
to
so
see
much,
everybody.
Yeah, it was nice meeting you all.
There you have it, folks. My first ever WWE employee roundtable discussion. And I really want to thank Jimmy, I want to thank Lou, and I want to thank Deb for taking time out of their schedule, coming together for that conversation. As you heard, we were from all different departments. Not everybody in there even was very well acquainted with everyone. And so I want to thank everybody for being a good sport, going with the flow, and making that into something that I think was very special. As I said, there are going to be more of those. That was the first one. Hope you enjoyed it. I hope you'll keep listening to Shut Up and Wrestle. Next week on the show, I'm very excited to bring to Shut Up and Wrestle Dominic D'Angelo, wrestling journalist, reporter, writer, podcaster. He will be my guest for next week's show. Also, in the weeks to come, my friends from the Whip Show podcast that I've been talking about, as well as Candace Cordelia of Pro Wrestling Illustrated, and many other guests, including the next roundtable that I am putting together. So do keep listening to Shut Up and Wrestle. You can find us at our website, suawpod.com. You can also find and subscribe to the show wherever you find your podcasts: Spotify, Podbean, Podcast Addict, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and the rest. If you would like to contribute to the show, and people have been doing that, and I'm very, very grateful for that, you can go to my Twitter page, Brian R. Solomon. You will find a button at the top, a money donation button that you can use to contribute via Venmo or Cash App. If you'd like to contribute via PayPal, you can find me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. Of course, this is not required. It is a free podcast, but all contributions are welcomed and appreciated. While you're at it, join the Shut Up and Wrestle Facebook group, Shut Up and Wrestle with Brian R. Solomon. We are now 1,600 plus members, going strong. Other projects that I work on that you can check out: the wrestling news from Arcadian Vanguard. Listen to it every day at thewrestlingnews.com. or the YouTube page for Arcadian Vanguard. The magazines that I write for, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Pro Wrestling Illustrated, you can get at pwi-online.com. Inside the Ropes magazine, you can get at insidetheropesmagazine.com. The books that I have written, Blood and Fire, the unbelievable real-life story of wrestling's original Sheik, you can find at Amazon or wherever books are sold, as well as Superheroes, the history of a pop culture phenomenon from Ant-Man to Zorro. And if you're interested in purchasing a signed copy, I do have a very small and dwindling amount of those remaining. Please feel free to reach out to me at BrianRSolomon@yahoo.com. And hopefully we can work something out. If you're looking for me on social media, I can be found at Brian R. Solomon on Twitter or Instagram. You can also find me on Facebook, my Facebook author page, Brian Solomon Writer. And on any of those social media platforms, you'll find the link to my author web page on the World Wide Web. Shut Up and Wrestle is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And as always, this has been Brian R. Solomon asking you to keep those cards and letters coming in and reminding you to take it easy, but take it. So long, wrestling fans. I need your pet.